And we're on page, I think it's 89. This is a very old piece. It's old material that came from Bodhidharma, the teacher who brought the Dharma from India to China and is considered to be the founder of Zen practice, or Chan practice in China, but it morphed into Zen when it got to Japan. The practice is just sitting. There was lots of Buddhism in China when he got there. Lots and lots. In fact, the most famous encounter he had when he first got there was with the emperor, who had built many temples and monasteries and had supported and was still supporting many, many practicers. And he asked Bodhidharma what kind of merit he had achieved by doing this good work. And Bodhidharma said no merit. And the emperor was very shocked and surprised and said, "Well, who are you?" And Bodhidharma said, "Don't know. Don't know." And he left. And then the emperor had second thoughts about it, and he said, "Go back and get him, somebody." And so he sent someone to fetch him back. And the fellow came back and said, "He's gone." But you know what? That was Avalokiteshvara. That was compassion itself. You missed it. So, Bodhidharma's teaching was very much more simple than Emperor Wu's practice and the support of the practice what he was supporting. Bodhidharma arrived and began to sit in a cave and just sat facing a wall. And so he brought this practice, not full of ritual, not full of so many ideas, but just the opportunity to sit down and explore what's here, what this is. And we've inherited that practice, which is quite remarkable. And so out of Bodhidharma's practice and his teaching came this Lankavatara Sutra, which at the moment is answering Mahamati's questions, his many, many, many questions, which are all around what this practice is about, sort of the basis of it. And the ones that we're looking at tonight are fleshing out the basic Buddhist practice. This has all been up to here, up to about a page 100, basic Buddhist practice. So in this one, we're at 17. Mahamati asks the Buddha, he constantly asks the Buddha, and the Buddha patiently answers. He says, "Bhagavan, the Tathagata teaches that what is eternal and inconceivable is the realm of ultimate truth, the realm of Buddha knowledge. One realizes oneself. Do other schools not teach what is eternal and inconceivable as a cause?" And the Buddha said, "The cause of other schools doesn't qualify as eternal and inconceivable." And because it's not the result of its own cause. So, it would be due to a creator in order for it to be. And the creator would have to have a cause, and that creator would have to have a cause, And so there's no way to go all the way back and find a first cause, though most religions posit a first cause of one kind. And Buddha says, ultimate truth is the result of a causal attribute that transcends existence and non-existence, because the attainment of personal realization is its attribute. It has an attribute, and because the knowledge of ultimate truth is its cause, it has a cause. But it's beyond existence and non-existence. It's space, nirvana, complete cessation, and that's why it's eternal. So then he goes on to talk about the other schools that teach the other way, and it gets very complicated. Because what is merely words and imagination is the same as rabbit horns. So he's saying it's beyond words. That's the main thing. It's beyond words, and it's each one's mind that's at work. There's nothing out there except what we project out there. In fact, it goes on to say we project everything out there. And at the end of this rather long and complicated couple of paragraphs, Red Pine says, as this distracts people from the attainment of personal realization of the realm of Buddha knowledge, it is not worth talking about. That's what the Buddha said. And Red Pine in his note says, amen. So I'm not going to go into it any more than that. I don't think we need to do that. So in the next one, he goes on to talk about Shravakas, who are very intense practicers, who are afraid of suffering that comes from the projection of samsara, looking for nirvana, not aware that the difference between samsara and nirvana, as well as their projection of everything else, does not exist. So in spite of their very sincere practice, they still believe that there is a goal, and the goal is some perfection, and that the perfection is different from where they actually are and how they actually are. And so they're attached to the perception of a realm outside the mind and keep turning the wheel of samsara. Samsara being the world of suffering, the world of birth and death. It's so easy to think there must be some other way and some other place, that this couldn't possibly be the place. This must be samsara. And what he's saying is that samsara and nirvana is a projection-free realm that is nothing but mind. So it transcends or incense or in some way it's it can't be what am I trying to say? You really can't say it because it's neither and both. We don't like that. We want things to be one thing or the other. So this is a prime example of how it's neither and both. It's how we project from our position our understanding of what it is that we see and experience. But it's coming from one place. It's coming from this place. So the shravakas are percepting a realm outside of the mind and then striving to get there, using the mind to strive to get there. Poor things. So, furthermore, Mahamati, nothing arises. This is what the Tathagatas of the past, the present, and the future teach. Birth and death are both illusions. Nothing arises. Everything is like horns on a rabbit or a horse, the mistaken projections of an imagined reality by ignorant beings. The non-arising that characterizes all that exists, this is the personal realization of the realm of Buddha knowledge. The existence that characterizes such things as your body, your possessions, and the world around you, Mahamati, is the interplay of the grasping and the grasped of repository consciousness. That's the big barn of our mind that has everything inside. Trapped by their dualistic views of origination, duration, and cessation, and their wish for things to arise, the ignorant give rise to projections of existence and non-existence, not the wise. He says, Mahamati, you should reflect on this in your practice. The interplay of the grasping and the grasped. Dualistic views of origination, duration, and cessation, and the wish for things to arise. I've been doing some research lately into places to live in town. And, of course, the first suggestion everybody has is a home for the elderly, seniors, senior homes, they call it now. And they are all set up to amuse the seniors. It's all set up with puzzles and games and music and little expeditions and... It's amazing. It's like when you go there, you don't have anything to do. And so it's all set up to give you things that you wish for, wish to arise. Otherwise, you just go bonkers, I guess, if you didn't have anything else to do. It's looking not quite right for me, I think, because I have too many things to do to want to be entertained continually with puzzles and games. But it's been very interesting kind of research to do and to talk to people about it and what it's like to live in that way. But it also seems to me that it's very much a part of this grasping and being grasped, that it's overlooking completely the real needs of people, especially at the end of life. It's a total distraction from death, which is, of course, the biggest subject for everybody in those places. So it's very interesting that way. Somebody suggested I should just start a sitting group there and turn the whole thing around. I don't know about that. So, furthermore, Mahamati, there are five lineages of realization. And then we get into the Shravakas and the Pratikabuddhas and the the Bodhisattvas. The Shravaka, the lineage of Shravaka realizations, upon learning how to put an end to the individual and shared characteristics of the skandhas, the dhatus and the ayatanas, in other words, putting an end to the idea of characteristics of the body and the mind, the hair on their entire body stands on end, and they delight in cultivating a knowledge of characteristics, but not in cultivating an awareness of dependent origination. So they can see through things, but they can't see how connected everything is. Dependent origination is the truth of how nothing is separate from anything. Everything is utterly connected to everything else, from here to the very edges of this universe and all the other universes. It's Buddha's basic teaching. But they don't get it. So they put an end to the arising of passion, but not to the habit energy of passion. And they escape karmic deaths, but do not escape imperceptible transformation deaths, the little tiny deaths that we suffer every moment. We're always dying and always being born again. It's hard to notice because we're in such a hurry. Says Mahamati, those whose realization is distant also seek nirvana, but think of it in terms of a self or a being or a life or an individuality. This is the Sarvastivadin school. And there are other followers of still other paths. This is a Hindu sect who think everything depends on a creator, and when its existence comes to an end, that's a nirvana. Those who think like this are incapable of seeing that there is no self in dharmas, and for them there's no liberation. These lineages of Shravaka realization and those of other schools do not transcend the concept of transcendence. They do not transcend the concept of transcendence. As for the lineage of Pratyekabuddha realization, upon hearing about the realization of different causal conditions, and this is the chain of independent origination that begins with ignorance and ends with old age and death. Ignorance creates, I've forgotten how it goes now, but one thing sets the other thing and the other thing sets the other thing, so that from not knowing, not being willing to see clearly the whole kit and caboodle that ends in death is created over and over and over again. So the Pratyekabuddhas are concerned Pratyekabuddha's realization upon hearing about the realization of different causal conditions. The hair on their entire body stands on end, and they weep tears of sorrow, and they avoid conditions or any attachment to them. But when they hear about different bodies and powers and different transformations involving combination and separation, Their minds are captivated. Anyone whose understanding belongs to the lineage of Pratyeka Buddha realization is taught in accordance with that path. As for the lineage of Tathagata realization, there are four kinds. One with a realization of the reality of dharmas, realization concerned with the non-reality of dharmas, concerned with the attainment of personal realization of Buddha knowledge, and with splendors of external Buddha lands. When someone hears these four described one after the other, as well as the inconceivable realm whereby their body possessions and the world around them are merely perceptions of their own minds, and they are not terrified or alarmed, this is what characterizes membership in the lineages of Tathagata realization. So, it's scary, or it can be scary. It's not in many ways what we would like. We really prefer the grasping and the pleasure to the hard work of seeing how things are. And yet without that hard work, we continue to suffer greatly. Through our misunderstanding, to see the world around us as a projected perception of our own minds and not be terrified. And yet, what else is there? So then he repeats this in verse, laying out what a Shravaka, a Pratyeka Buddha, and a Bodhisattva are. And ends saying, dhyanas and boundless states, samadhis devoid of form, cessation of perception, these don't exist where there is only mind. So we identify many different states, many different passages of our own mind. We inherit many definitions of how we should be understanding things, but ultimately, it's just our own mind. So then it goes into Ichantikas, which we also find in Bendoa, both Dogen's Bendoa. Ichantikas are supposed to be the irredeemable folks who just can't make it no matter what. And it's saying here that even Ichantikas can practice and become Buddha. That nothing is left out, even the hopeless, impossible ones. When I first heard that, I felt so much better. It was such a relief. Oh, good. I know I'm an Ichantika. So at least there's room for people like me as well. And he said there are two kinds of Ichantikas. There are the Ichantikas that really don't get it. And there are the ones who are the Bodhisattva Ichantikas, who choose to be Ichantikas in order to practice with the Ichantika level of beings, which is, I suppose, a sort of a great original sacrifice in a way. bodhisattva ichandakas know that everything is already in nirvana. So they never enter nirvana. They don't even try. They know they're already there. This is not true of those ichandakas who forsake their good roots. Even though they forsake their good roots through the power of the Tathagata, at some point their good roots reappear. Because Tathagatas don't forsake any being. That is why Bodhisattva Ichandakas do not enter nirvana. So this is heartening. Usually we separate the good guys and the bad guys. The smart ones and the dumb ones. The wise ones and the dumb ones. It isn't making those distinctions. The practice is seeing how things are as they are. And in the truth of things, those distinctions are an illusion to which we can observe and enjoy without attachment. Or we can become all tangled up in them and imagine that it's all the way we think it is. But our thinking, as we know in our practice, is pretty feeble stuff. And if we depend on our thinking instead of our actual depth of understanding, we can't be clear about how things are. So this is all a big encouragement to practice, of course. Oh, it's almost 8 o'clock. So I will stop there. Are there questions? There must be questions.
This citation you read basically saying that nirvana is a myth as we think about it, and that there is no difference between samsara and nirvana.
Yeah.
It's kind of a relief.
It is a relief. It is. And it's not such an esoteric idea either. Every artist knows that. It's what art is based on, is expressing nirvana in samsara, so-called. It's expressing the depth of the life that we live as we do, beneath the superficial part that we take so for granted with our thinking mind. But if you begin to play music or paint or write from the heart and the belly, then you're beginning to express from the essence of things, from the so-called nirvana side. But there's no nirvana side. It's just this. It's just the wonder of this altogether, just as it is. Well, I'm sorry I went on so long. It's 8 o'clock. But we'll do some more next week. So.